Nilqakom għal program iħor sekwestru mi għendru għat soparti program illi naturalment se nkun qiegħed nitratta għal darbohra t-tema ta' sekwestru ta' serq ta' nis ta' kidnaps kif ngħidu kif jingħad bl-Ingliż ta' abductions huwa fenomenu li huwa aktar komuni milli naħsbu għal raġunijiet differenti, għal raġunijiet politiċi, soċjali, għal raġunijiet ta' abbuż ta' tfal, abbuż ta' minorenni. U allura huwa suġġett li fil-fema tiegħi kien jimmerita ħafna u ħafna diskussjoni kif fil-fatt qegħdin nagħmlu, qegħdin nittrattaw setturi u oqsma differenti. Jiena biex nagħmel dir id-diskussjoni, illum ser inkun qiegħed nitkellem mal-professur Vivian Lee. Vivian Lee hija Amerikana da kif ġiet u Malta qed tgħallem ġewwa l-Università ta' Malta u allura l-konverzazzjoni tagħna se tkun bl-Ingliż. M'għandix dubju li se tkun qegħdin issegwu tieħdu gost xorta waħda bil-programm tagħna. So I'm assuming you understood everything, Vivian.
Oh, absolutely.
I've just said that you've just arrived in Malta, that yes. You'll be teaching at our university.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
And that we'll be discussing, we'll be starting off from a particular narrative of this young girl, Elizabeth Smart. She's quite a personality. She turned out to be quite a celebrity in a way.
Yes.
Following her kidnap, she didn't just get sort things out for herself, but she did try and give a service also to a number of in a number of occasions. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, she does go around in schools and colleges.
Yes.
Does her share of motivational speeches. So, first and foremost, thank you very much for finding
the
time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Your interest in counseling, your interest in your profession.
Mm-hmm.
Why your profession? Why this profession?
Well, first off, I love the profession of counseling. Yeah. I think it is a profession that offers a tremendous amount, not only to individuals and groups, but to society as well, and the opportunity to help individuals grow and develop and meet their full potential in ways that they can thrive and become productive in society. Explore their talents, their hopes, their dreams, their goals, and have a quality of life that helps them to enjoy the gifts that they were given and strive for their dreams to come true. I think it also is a way for us to look at the beauty and complexity and simplicity in life, and to be able to look at that from a global perspective. And the needs and the human rights of the whole human family. And counseling has a big role in that. So it really is, actually to me, the profession is a gift. And I feel very humbled and honored to be able to be a part of a profession that I think gives back so much to the human family. So this is in education and counseling, I guess I hate to say it, but you're 34. I'm giving away too much.
Yeah, yeah.
But
be that you are born a counselor.
I totally was
that's 34.
That is it. No, but why I say that though is it's a profession that is wonderful to grow as a lifetime career, and that to grow and actually mature within the career and teach is, again, I would say, a beautiful gift.
America's slightly bigger than Malta.
Slightly.
Yeah, just a bit.
Just a bit.
And every state in America is like going to a different country. I mean, even within the state, within each state, I've been to Minnesota, and it's like going from one area to another. It's like going to a different part of Minnesota. It looks very different, it feels very different, it smells very different,
yes.
You eat very different.
Mm-hmm.
So my obvious question would be, from which part of America do you
come? Okay. So I am what would be known as true East Coast.
Okay.
I was born in New York City.
All right.
Yeah. And lived there for just a few years as a child, and then grew up in New Jersey. But I've spent most of my professional career in the state of Virginia. where I did my graduate work at University of Virginia. And we, when we moved here to Malta, we were living in Maryland, which is all East Coast, not too far from the ocean, about an hour and a half from the ocean.
And the ocean, as in the Atlantic Ocean. You can swim in the ocean, or is it very dangerous?
No, the Atlantic on the beaches is really wonderful.
Okay.
All up and down the East Coast, there are beautiful beaches that you can enjoy. The North Carolina and South Carolina beaches in Florida, just beautiful. Virginia Beach, they're really family-oriented and fun and enjoyable. I love the East Coast.
Okay, so it was a sort of a natural progression coming to Malta with all the sea around us.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And we've been a number of times before coming this time, so.
Yeah. And your involvement over there professionally, obviously, what were you focusing on?
Okay. So I did actually two different things. For the past 9 years, I've carried two jobs. The main job that I was carrying was, I was the senior director for counselor advocacy at the National Office for School Counselor Advocacy. And we were located in Washington, D.C., and our focus was really looking at helping to address the inequities, the injustices, in educational opportunity, and how to train counselors, work with the state departments of education, work with administrators and school districts to really, really look at ensuring that all groups of students were having equitable educational opportunity and the type of counseling and multicultural competence that school counselors and educators needed to be able to provide appropriate service. The demographic in our nation is rapidly changing and becoming more diverse than it's ever been, which is a wonderfully beautiful thing.
Do all Americans think that way?
Probably not. I think most do, though. I mean, but as America we are, we're very diverse, which is great. But there can still be some issues in that not everybody of every group is having the opportunities that others have. And part of our work was to ensure that they were, because one of the things that we were looking at as a national focus, as different demographic groups grow, they need to have education and the degrees and readiness necessary to be able to successfully participate in society and contribute. Mm-hmm. And without education in our country, really looking at post-secondary education, tertiary, university, some post-secondary education, there really are not jobs or jobs that are going to allow individuals to make a living and be able to, in sometimes often instances, live without government or public assistance. Mm. And so it doesn't allow them to fully engage. And when individuals in any society can't fully engage, then they're not really going to be as productive as possible, and then inequities are visible and grow. People are unhappy. And that's not really how you want to grow a country. And so the kinds of changes that we're seeing are really to look at what is the kind of educational opportunity that needs to be afforded to all of our children across the entire nation so that our educational outcomes are equitable. And that was really what our office was charged with, and teaching and training counselors as well as teachers and administrators to be able to do that. I also did work with a number of, you know, as you said, in different states. Each state has a State Department of Education. And those
would it be standardized? Would the system be standardized, or a state could have a completely different?
Yes, they can. That's part of how our system is made up, is states' rights. There are national standards, but states have freedom within that. And so what we were trying to do was to help states move towards the national expectation of educational outcomes. And those equity pieces really take in an understanding of multicultural competence and cultural competence, and being able to address and work with effectively different groups of people. And it's important because cultural understanding and effective communication is really a skill that's important to have. Different cultures have different ways And that's okay. Yeah. But the understanding of how to build bridges between that in the best interest of children is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our work was around that. And then in working with the departments of education, I did work in helping them review their policies, their protocols, so that the way in which they had expectations on their schools and school districts, we form into school districts, that they were helping them to move forward in ways that were going to get those kinds of outcomes. Because when we're graduating students from secondary education and their skills are not on par with what the expectation for employment is, then they have a piece of paper, but they don't have the skills. Mm. And so, and our schools, I think, are doing a really good job, but we need to keep progressing forward and making sure that it's about all of the children. And so we were very involved in that, in research and publications, to be able to have the tools that counselors needed to do that kind of work. And that was really a new movement. Our main focus was looking at college and career readiness. When we say college, we mean university.
Okay.
College and career readiness for all of our students. So whether they went directly on to university or they went to other post-secondary tertiary education, that they had the knowledge and skills in math, reading, writing, so all of those kinds of things, technology, that they could walk in, be ready to go, and function effectively and not drop out.
Mm. So you're getting to know about Malta.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to believe that everybody in the world knows about Malta, but the probability is that that wouldn't be the case. So how did you get to know about Malta? I mean, what was there collaboration going on between the universities?
Yes. Well, in fact, the other part of what I did was work at the University of Maryland as an adjunct professor, associate professor there. And we were involved with the International Association for Counseling. And in 2007, that conference was held in Cork, Ireland.
Okay.
And a Maltese delegation came, who are now our colleagues.
Okay.
And their interest in becoming involved with IAC, the International Associate of Counseling, IAC, and having a conference in Malta.
Okay.
And so in 2008, the IAC conference was held in Malta. And I have to tell you, it was a fabulous conference. They outdid themselves. Everything they could possibly do to make it an extraordinary conference, they did. We had a wonderful turnout.
If Ruth Fulton was involved, there was no doubt about it.
It was wonderful. Yes. And so from then on, we began an association. The current president at that time, Courtland Lee, was president, began conversation and Dione Mifsud. And so there began talk around the International Master's Program, which is the dual degree program with the University of Maryland and University of Malta in transcultural counseling.
That's right.
And we're in our second cohort now. And so we began to come over regularly, in fact, every year since 2008, and teaching a class or working in summer school. And what began as new acquaintances and colleagues have become like family to us now. It's wonderful. It really, really is wonderful. So that's how we got here.
Okay. So I thought we'd discuss a bit the dynamics of a particular narrative. Elizabeth Smart, this young girl. She's still very young, but at the time she was just 14. She was found, she was abducted and found alive 9 months later in Salt Lake City, Utah. And this was back in 2003. And she was found 18 miles away from home. And I'd like to pick on that as well. 18 miles is nothing for the United States.
No.
Maybe for us it's a bit, but for the United States it's nothing. So I'd like to pick on that at a later stage. And she was found in the company of or the company of her captors, Mitchell and Barzi, and they were indicted for her kidnapping. This girl, and that's something about this as well. She didn't just try and get it sorted out for herself, but she ended up doing motivation speeches and talks, and really has worked a lot with young people, with people in college, and she has told about her story. The first almost obvious simplistic question, but why do people need to steal other people? Why do people need to kidnap people? What goes on in people's minds when they arrive at a point where they need to have this type of position? So it's not just about running away with one of the mics here in the studio, but taking somebody else's life and making it in a way your own. What brings people to do that?
Well, Andrew, it's a very big question, quite frankly. And well, perpetrators of kidnapping is not necessarily my specialty area. In looking at it, and again, I read some on the case because that's how I came to know about it, is seeing it in the media and reading some on it. Apparently, the individuals involved had a high degree of mental health issues, and at times it was reported that there was question of whether or not they were capable of standing trial. And in their belief or distorted belief that somehow that was what they were doing was okay, was acceptable, although we know clearly it is not. But somehow in their reasoning, again, within the seriousness of their what we could look at mental health issues, they believed that that was an acceptable way to meet their needs. Mm. Although we realize, quite frankly, it's quite not, very far from quite not.
Would this be something that, I mean, getting away from this particular story, but would this be the first thing of the sort, or would they have had a number of things coming up in their lives that would have, so this is the culmination, the maximum prize, or people just they sort of drive themselves into such situations?
I don't know. I think you would have to look at different perpetrators and what each one is. I'm sure there are some patterns there as well as some differences. You don't know, obviously. In reading the case, it seems clear that it was not just an overnight thing, that apparently it's reported that he had worked at the house and done at the Smart's home.
That's
and
right.
Had done some work That's at right. the home. So apparently one could say and look at it that there was some seeing that young girl was there. So rather than just saying, wake up one day, this is going to happen, one could say from reading
it. Almost sounds like an obsession in a way, because you saw,
could be, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do people come out of this? Because that is what I'm interested mostly in exploring with you, because I'm sure you've worked with young people who have passed through traumatic experiences, maybe not exactly but how can people, following such a big trauma, such a big thing that happened in their life, come out of this and manage to get on with their life?
Well,
does everyone manage to get on with it?
Well, I think what you're looking at there is healing from traumatic events. Traumas, and depending on the types of traumas, can have different outcomes. So this is a trauma born out of a human act rather than what one might call an act of God, like a hurricane or a volcano.
So it impacts in a different way?
Some belief is that it is, that trauma at the hand of another human being can be more serious, in that it's a human to a human interaction rather than a tsunami or such. Not that that's not tremendous trauma, because it is, but a piece of the human condition can add to that. Many effects of that, from PTSD. So part of it, if you could say, well, one has had this event, So how do you begin to put life back together to really look at, here's the what we might call the narrative of a life, the story of one's life, okay? So if you think about what's the story of your life, and you can clearly see kind of as the pattern has gone along what the story of your life is. So in terms of a traumatic event, that narrative or story or your plans for your future is abruptly stopped, changed in ways against your control, violently, one's person defiled. So when you're looking at that kind of trauma, it stops almost time in an instant. And then in coming out of that, time has passed. Other people have changed as well, families, after those years. But almost like that time has stood still. Then it's how do you help somebody to begin to have, first off, physical safety? You know, if we think about, if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, how do we begin to first have physical safety, psychological safety, create a safe environment, becomes a really important piece around trauma.
So the safety first principle comes into
yeah, that one's self, you know, that self, that physical self is safe and protected. Critically important. And then, too, the understanding that the trauma isn't going to heal itself overnight, nor should one be forced to talk. Sometimes words don't come, and that's okay. And then as it gradually can, if so, that there is the ability to have one and support to listen, and sometimes that needs to be rehashed over and over again, but not to say to one, well, you should get past. One can never understand what someone else has endured in such a situation, and the support and the openness, the gentleness, the patience to help one be able to gain control over their life again, or even in some of the situations to be able to do basic things for oneself again.
Would it be easier to work with a 12, 13-year-old, a 6-year-old who has gone through similar experience, to traumatic experience involving human beings? Or is it easier to work with adolescents? Or is it easier to work with adults? Is there a formula that makes it easier, or there are other components, other factors, that other issues that factor into the effectiveness of how people respond to therapy, how people respond to...
Well, I think in looking at trauma and in looking at counseling around that, you're looking at also different cognitive levels, different developmental levels. So if you have a young child who has a trauma, they might not have... Although what you can find is that the resilience of people is huge.
It's enormous. I've been through a number of stories of the sort, and I've seen features on YouTube, and the way people have come out of these. I have dealt with them, and the way they speak about their experiences. I've recently read the story of Natasha Kompish, for example, and I've read Camp 14 as well. People have been kept in camps for something like all their lives. But the resilience, it's incredible. It's phenomenal.
And I think that piece of knowing that we have the ability to heal, we do have tremendous resilience. But I think it's also, you know, depends on what has happened, the support that's there, the counseling that's there, really becomes an important piece to support these individuals through trauma, for any kind of trauma. Support and counseling and understanding, family support, and also, too, I think support for those who are the caregivers or the family members of an individual who has suffered a type of trauma.
They're getting back a very different person, probably.
I would imagine so, yes, of course. So, be it any trauma, how you left somebody in the morning and the trauma they had, they come home different, but you left them without that trauma. So your perception of them is as they were.
Mm.
And so in looking at, so how do you help support families who have family members who have gone through a trauma, is their belief and their understanding about what happened, whatever that trauma might be, to that family member. There may be feelings of guilt or shame or helplessness, lack of control, its own sense of loss, you know, in looking at stages of grief and loss. If only I had, I wish I could have, if I could relive that moment, I would, you know, those types of things. You know, when you love somebody, you want to be there for them.
Mm.
Can leave people feeling helpless. Perhaps they didn't fulfill their obligation.
Mm. It's interesting that recently there was this Ohio case in Cleveland, and one of the victims, allegedly, because I mean information is very scarce at the moment, rightly so, because they are trying to protect these individuals from the media. I'd like to pick on that as well. But one of the abductees, one of the girls that was kidnapped, has taken her quite a bit to come to terms with relating with her family.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, she doesn't seem to want to be part of that family. Probably there are various mm-hmm. dynamics, but people do change. So having family is not an obvious. It's not the obvious place where people will find happiness or will find comfort. So, how would the media? What is the best thing that the media should be doing? And how does the media impact on the individuals, on the family? And
well, it's interesting that you ask that
because you see people crying and telling about their stories and want our daughter back. I'm sure the FBI and all these agencies would have filtered that decision. So there's a scope for that. So how would that impact?
Well, I think media is important and serves a very important purpose in our society. But I also think that there's a need for privacy for individuals. And again, there is very little information, which I quite frankly think is very good in a sense, in that the privacy and the details, I don't know, need to be out there while they're working a case and such as that. But I read in one of the articles about the Elizabeth Smart case when she was interviewed about another topic and was pushed on about the details, was very clear in saying, this is what I'm here to do. And I think that that's an important piece. When you think about trauma and you think about loss of control and helplessness, respecting one's rights to have control over their life and what they say and themselves is a very important piece of that, I think, and being able to be respectful of that, and for somebody to be able to say no, and no being respected. And in terms of the media, while people are curious, that it's not at the expense of others trying to sort out and heal in ways that are best for them. And maybe they may never share that, and that's okay. If that's their way of healing and what is best for them, and I would respect that.
I've read this about Elizabeth Smart, and I've seen also YouTube clips where she says that the way that she's been potentially, possibly abused physically is something that she doesn't want to share. Right. But then it's interesting that then there's another case of a Natasha Kampusch, which happened in Austria, where she gives the details of the abuse, of the sexual abuse, and she has a counter argument. She has an opposite argument, I would say, that she says talking about it is very important for me because I want to show that this wasn't about me, but it was about him, and it was about the way that he abused me. So people tackle issues in a different way. So
they do.
So what would a counselor do there? I mean, would the values of the counselor come into play, or would you suggest this, and that is a bit of you that you should keep for yourself, or that is a bit of you that you should talk about it because it is very important that you face it, you have a bit of a catharsis about it, and so that you can get on with your life, with your sexual relationships, with your life?
Well, I think that in a counseling situation, a counselor would work with a client to explore the issues of the trauma and work with it. However, that doesn't necessitate that it be made public.
Okay.
So different individuals may choose to deal in a different way. More a counselor would work with them in, can they handle it? Is it what they want? Is it robbing control again from them? Is it how they choose to heal and conduct their life at this point in time? Because again, in any trauma, one basically can losing control. Mm-hmm. How does one regain that? To dictate how one should heal is again having power over, rather than helping to empower another to let their life go forward as they would like to. Any kind of healing, for example, sometimes if we have the loss of a family member, which is something we all experience at one point in time or another.
This is a loss.
Indeed. We all deal with loss a little differently. People grieve differently. And sometimes you can see conflicts in families when people don't think that others are grieving the way they grieve or should grieve in other ways. We have to allow people to grieve and grow and heal in their own way. Rather than saying healing is defined as you must do this or this. If someone would choose not to make that public, as a counselor, I would respect that. If they chose to, would have to be also be able to help them work through what the potential outcomes of that may be, and are they ready to handle or deal with that? But again, I think it's a gentle process, has to be a gentle process, and one that respects the rights and maintains the empowerment and helps create the empowerment for the person.
This is an awfully unfair question, but is talking to people enough for them to be able to deal with these issues? Having sessions, having counseling sessions in such traumatic situations like abductions, like either being the victim of abductions or as the family that is involved, possibly the perpetrator, is talking a permanent solution? Can you get permanent solutions by talking, by discussing?
I don't know that I look at counseling as a permanent solution. Because I think that and really believe that we evolve through our life and grow in our journey.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So, and I think healing in many things is an ongoing process. Counseling can help one deal with emotions, come to terms with issues, but counseling also helps individuals in planning how they want to go out into the world and the types of things they want to do. So it's not just we sit one-on-one, we talk about it, you go out there and it's done. It may be that in a session one would talk about when you encounter A or B, how would you deal with that? And then one can go and practice that. And so it becomes a way that somebody, not just in traumatic counseling, other types of counseling as well, how do you actually help somebody engage better in life, in things that they do and encounter relationships. The counselor can help model a relationship that is empowering and not one that takes power. And in that way, to help an individual gain some of the self-confidence and self-esteem to go out and begin to engage life again, go shopping or have a relationship or whatever.
So the counseling sessions, it becomes like a model relationship in a way.
Hopefully. So that reparative notion can exist within the counseling relationship itself.
I'd like to draw in the community for a moment. In the beginning of the show, we mentioned that she was kept something like 18 miles away from where she was abducted, and 18 miles is like probably like from here to go to or something. I mean, it's not like going from here to Rome or. What does this say about the community? Do you think that it has anything to do with our communities no longer being communities, or sort of disinterested state of affairs where what your neighbor is doing has become so personal and so individual that it has nothing to do with us? Or is it a coincidence that nobody got to know about this before, and the girl was unlucky? But I don't know what your take be on in a general sense, not in this particular situation.
Well, I think first off, I wouldn't want to blame any community. I don't engage blame games. But I do clearly see what you're asking in that. Do we actually see each other and engage with each other, and how do communities function, and what does it mean to have a close-knit community? We are much more, I think now anyway, given my age, I think we maybe are somewhat more disconnected than we were before. We live very fast-paced, busy lives. We get up, we go to work, we work all day, we come home, you know, very, very much into our worlds. Is it possible that we don't see things that go on around us that are right in front of us? Sure, it is. Sure.
Can this change? Or should it change?
I think in some places, I know in the community that we lived in Maryland before coming here, and in many communities that I've seen in the U.S., they have things, community groups, community captains and things that try and be of assistance, or if somebody perhaps is elderly or infirmed, could help with a meal or taking somebody shopping or something like that, to generally become aware of the goings on in a community. Is that a good thing? I do think so. To be connected and have a sense of community, I do. Not to impinge others' privacies, but to be able to have a sense of what the tone of a community is. That it was missed that close, that is hard to fathom, yet at the same time we try and protect privacies too as well, don't we, in our communities?
So
and
the difficult
tender issues, balance
is,
find the balance,
which is extremely difficult. I can't not bring in obviously the captor, the abductor. I mean, would you be ready to work with somebody like that? Or would you say, listen, his, it doesn't merit my time, if you know what I mean, or I have such an issue with, you know, taking people and treating them as slaves and behaving that way that I will not have time for that. But, you know, would you engage professionally with this, with such people?
Well, let me talk about it from a counseling perspective first, in terms of the work of counselors. In working with all types of clients, in counseling, many of us find our areas of specialty, places where we feel most drawn to issues, individuals or groups such as that. And for many of those areas, there are some specialty trainings that go along with that. And so I think in looking at working with perpetrators of any type of crime or traumas like this, first off requires some specific types of, and this is a very, very severe case which requires specialty training. It is perpetrators of that, of those types of crimes is not my specialty, and the specific training for that I would need to engage. However, I think in terms of understanding the human family that we're all a part of, if that was my area of expertise, yes, I would engage. Because I obviously would have that belief that that's the area that I chose to work, would want to work, would train to work, and would do that work. Mm. I think there's a need for counseling with perpetrators to understand. As you spoke earlier in the program, you asked about what, in kind of a disbelief tone, almost, which I can very much appreciate, and saying, my goodness, what was going on in their minds? So we do have a need to know and understand and be able to help individuals heal from not committing those acts and to understand what is needed, the type of therapy and such.
You do believe that they can be healed? They can heal?
Again, without that specifics and each looking more deeply in cases, one would hope that they might not be able to be healed. In terms of wanting to say that one may need medication, may need specific kinds of therapy and training, but again, that level of expertise is not one I choose, so I don't want to speak outside of my. I would have an ethical issue with myself around that, and I'm very careful about that. Yeah. But my hope is always for healing, to the degree which that can be, and to have wellness. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is severe issues, and very off for a time in reading through the case, looking at for a long time, he was seen as not fit to stand trial.
That's right.
Was seen as, you know, not competent to stand trial. So, you know, one would ask, where along the way in one's life did this happen? What happened to this person that led to this? And we need therapeutic work to be done to understand. We need prevention.
Could something of this sort be identified earlier on? I can't believe that people who... I don't think that... people can pass through particular experiences in their life where things change drastically or a condition develops halfway through your life and something, completely changes. But in many of these situations, when serial killers, abductors, kidnappers, people who have a criminal record, this didn't just start out of the blue.
There are events and issues.
So, finishing probably from where we started, mentioning schools, should schools have noticed that somebody would be
going
the wrong side of the road, or?
Well, I think what's a positive thing for schools is to have positive environments and environments that promote the self-esteem and the empowerment of children, to help them have good relationships where they can develop in ways that are healthy. And good positive prevention for healthy growth and development in schools that attends to social and emotional growth, I think, is an important piece along with their academic growth and development. So to be able to address the whole child in those ways, yeah, and when children are having difficult times, that we do have counseling and other services available for children so that they can work through that, and services for families. because children live in families.
In context,
exactly right. And I think that that becomes an important piece, that when we're looking at counseling, that we understand children and individuals within the context in which they live or come to live in a place, and respect and honor that context and what needs to happen to help foster healthy growth and development.
But I get the impression that, I know this is another unfair one, but I get the impression that counseling is very individual. It's very coming to my office and having a conversation. Or is that a shift of working within the home and within the community and going out instead of expecting people to come to the professionals?
You just asked a question I love. Well, I do think more and more in counseling we're seeing the shift in movement to understanding systems.
Yeah.
As people, we live in systems. Schools in and of themselves are systems. And being able to understand the influence from the multiple areas of influence is important. I think if we think just sitting one-to-one is going to solve everything without understanding the context in which one lives and the influences and how that's important, I don't really find...
Subscribe.
I don't. My counseling is very much from a systems-oriented perspective and what that looks like across time as we evolve as people.
We're on the same wavelength, I think.
Yeah. Yes, very much
well,
so. I really believe
speaking
that.
Speaking about wavelengths, we've got to call this a show. We have to stop.
Wow,
It went quickly. I'd like to thank you. I really
and
hope
you
have
you well.
a good summer and obviously a good stay. I had with me Professor Vivian Lee from the Department of Counseling, right? From
yes.
the Faculty of Social Wellbeing.
Yes.
The program Sequestro will be with you today week.